So much, Joe, for that introduction, and thanks so much for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be here and to be speaking to all of you, the audience. Thank you for attending and for those who are going to be watching later. So, yeah, my talk is based on my book, Millennials Talking Media. So the title here is Intertextual Media References in Millennial Conversation. And this image is from the cover of my book. And I'll explain a little more later kind of who these people are and how they ended up on the cover. And why they're painted as video game characters, because they are real people, including the cats. So I thought first I'd start us off actually with an example, just to get right into it and show you what I'm interested in looking at here. So this example is going to be a media reference and more specifically a film reference. So I'm interested in how people quote a variety of media, and one of those forms of media could be a film. So, I'm just going to briefly introduce one of the major concepts here, which is intertextuality. This can be just briefly as the repetition of prior texts. And in this case, I'm referring to media texts. So, not, literal text, but it could be images, sound, and different things too. And this is going to be relevant here. So, the example I'm going to show you first is coming from a recorded conversation, just an everyday conversation, unprompted, among three American millennial friends in their mid-20s. So, Lana was a student in my graduate program, and Fred was her housemate. And in this conversation, I'm over at their house. And ironically, Lana and I had actually been discussing the difficulty in defining intertextuality. So I just gave you a very simple definition, but it's actually a really complex topic. And we were both graduate students. She was writing a paper on this. I was taking a seminar in it. So that's how this came up. And you're going to see us discussing this. And then you're going to see a media reference, a film reference, and that's going to be highlighted for you with arrows and with quotation marks around the reference. So I'm just going to show you the transcript of the conversation and play the recording first, and then I will reveal the film clip itself that this is coming from. But let's see if any of you recognize this first. So this is the transcript, and now I'm going to play the audio, and I hope you can hear it. I'm actually realizing I did not share this to optimize sound, but let's see how it is, and you can let me know.
I'll let you know. He says, I keep thinking that I know what I mean.
I know, it's
well,
really
we're all using
confusing.
words that we don't know what they mean.
Keep using that word. I don't think he knows what it means.
I don't know what you mean. What you're thinking.
I'm like, it's just a fancy word for illusion.
I...
Whatever.
Well,
okay, I hope you can hear that. Yeah, just let me know if not, but it seems like it was heard. So, yeah, as I said here, you see highlighted where the media reference comes in. So here, right, we're talking about the concept of intertextuality, talking about how we're not sure we know what it means. I said it's confusing. And Fred says, wow, we're all using words that we don't know what they mean. And then you get the media reference right here. You keep using that word, I don't think you mean you know what it means, and then it gets kind of repeated, repaired here, and a little accent gets added as well. Good, Alba, I see you understood the reference. So for those of you who didn't, let's watch the film clip that this is coming from now, and then we'll look at it again. Okay, so I just put the text along the bottom. Let me play this. It takes a second to start.
Even far? Inconceivable. You keep using the word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
Okay, so this is coming from the film The Princess Bride. This was really popular in North America in the early 90s. In this case, they're referring to a man that was scaling a cliff, I think. And this character here says he didn't fall, inconceivable. And this other character says, you keep using that word. I do not think it means what you think it means. So that's what those speakers were referencing. And, notice that this man is playing a Spanish character. He's actually not Spanish, but he does kind of perform that accent. And then we see Fred performing that in the example. So let's look at that again once more. So again, you can see how this, we're all using words that we don't know what they mean, kind of triggers me to think of this reference, right? So you get it here. You keep using that word. I don't think you know what it means. And here, Fred, as I said, repairs this, and he actually does, he performs a little bit of that Spanish accent here. And you see all this laughter around that. And kind of, you know, previewing my argument here is that, you know, we were talking about this difficult concept. It was a bit awkward. And Fred is actually not a grad student, so he doesn't necessarily have a way to participate in this talk. But this media reference allows him a way to participate more fully in the conversation. And so it sort of helps to construct this shared group bonding and identity around kind of knowing the same media. Okay, so now that I've given you a glimpse of the kind of data I'm looking at, I'll kind of back up and talk about my research questions and theoretical background and the data and methods. So my overarching research question is, how are social identities constructed in everyday communication? This has always been fascinating to me, and this is really at the heart of all my research. And when I was a graduate student, I got really interested in approaching this through knowledge and how is the display of knowledge involved. So in the example you just saw, they're drawing on knowledge about a film that they've seen. How can the way that people repeat words they've heard or seen before contribute to knowledge management and identity construction? And this is how I got, you know, specifically focused on these media references. And furthermore, how are talk activities, or more formally referred to as frames of talk, and the related tone of talk, how are these things involved in these processes? So I'll talk a little more about identity and knowledge construction. Fancy word for this is epistemics. So identity is something that scholars have discussed as emergent in discourse, and we're looking at everyday talk. It's not something that exists in advance or a priori. It's something that speakers jointly construct together through their talk. And I got interested in this area of epistemic discourse analysis more specifically. So the study of the ways knowledge is interactively managed in the structures and strategies of text at talk. And this article by Raymond and Heritage was really crucial to my early interest in this, where they showed how epistemics contributes to social identity. So the way that people manage knowledge and their access to different kinds of knowledge constructs their social identities. And Heritage in particular and others have done a lot of work following that up in conversation analysis. And I got interested early on in group epistemics because the early work on this, like a lot of CA work, was just done on dyadic interactions with two people. So I'm interested in larger groups and how they manage this, and also considering the social context a little bit more and the relationships of the participants and just all aspects of the social context that speakers bring with them into the interaction. So I'll talk a little more now about intertextuality. And this is kind of just a greatest hits of intertextuality and some of my favorite quotes. So Bakhtin was a philosopher and literary theorist who kind of developed this concept. And he writes that every word spoken is half ours and half someone else's. So you see that in this data, the speakers are often pulling prior texts. So they're half someone else's, but then they're making them their own and they're often modifying them to fit the interactional context. And Kristeva expanded on Bakhtin's work, and she writes that each text is a mosaic of quotations. Any text is the absorption and transformation of another, and we can extend this to everyday conversation. Becker also observed that social groups seem to be bound primarily by a shared repertoire of prior texts. So this is what you're going to see in the talk today, is how these social groups of friends have this whole shared universe of prior texts. And Norick also writes that the complementary exhibition of shared knowledge, particularly when it involves some specialized or arcane source, attests to common interests and encourages mutual involvement. So some of the examples, especially in my book, are very specialized and arcane and niche. I think today I'm trying to show you some that I think maybe more people will get. But there's sort of something to that idea that the more specialized or niche it is, you know, the more potential there for mutual involvement and bonding. So I'll talk about how some scholars have extended intertextuality into everyday conversation and discourse analysis. So this has been studied basically by a lot of Georgetown scholars, which is where I studied and got my PhD. And these scholars focused on the role intertextuality plays in identity, relationships, and meanings in families specifically. And part of this has been tying intertextuality to framing, which I mentioned earlier. So framing refers to what is the activity of talk. So like right now, the frame is that I'm giving a talk, I'm giving a lecture, but we can also see play frames. That's the most common kind of frame that we see emerging in my data. But you could also have an argumentative frame. You could have a flirting frame, all these different kinds of, you know, activities that people do with their talk. And related to that is looking at keying. So what is the tone of talk? Is it fun? Is it angry? That goes hand in hand with framing. And I also became really intrigued by this Marjorie Goodwin paper where she showed that shifting frames solves interactional dilemmas. And I'll be showing you this throughout the data, how oftentimes there's an interactional dilemma. In other words, some kind of awkward or maybe unpleasant moment. And speakers will use media references to shift out of that frame and to make it a more playful frame. And Tannen observes something similar. She looks at how former arguments can be reframed in a humorous key. And she looks at this in a family. So she shows how this can reinforce shared family identity. So a family might be arguing in the morning, and by the end of the day, they're joking about their argument. And then Gordon really brought together intertextuality and framing. So I'm really building on her work. And she shows how often when you have some kind of intertextuality in an interaction, it also triggers a change in frame. So now I'll talk a bit more specifically about media, texts, and references, which is my specific focus. So Becker had just made this intriguing observation that apparently free conversation is a replay of remembered texts from TV news, radio talk, and the New York Times. So kind of just speculating about, you know, all the different things we might repeat and refer to in our everyday talk. And then this was followed up. One of the first pieces I read, actually examining this empirically, was work by Ala Tovarez. And she focused specifically on television text and everyday talk, and once again, in family context. So she showed how families would refer to TV shows they were watching to construct involvement with one another, shared identities around these TV shows, to form alignments with each other, to socialize their children, and also just for entertainment within the family. And then my first foray into this was actually looking at video game references, and I'll show you some examples today. And I showed how these, again, resolve interactional dilemmas through what I call epistemic frame shifts. So merging epistemics with framing here. And what that looks like is that the intertextual knowledge that is required to shift to a play frame, that will lead to some kind of group identity construction. And I thought there was something else there. But basically, at the same time, when that frame shift is happening, right, that knowledge shift is also happening. So when you pull in a media text to a conversation, you're shifting both the frame and the source of knowledge required to participate in that new play frame. So that's why I call them epistemic frame shifts. Okay, now I'll get into my data and methods. So Tannen, one of my mentors, had observed that recording a conversation among friends makes available for study patterns of language use that do not emerge among strangers, such as playful routines, irony and allusion, reference to familiar jokes, and unstated assumptions. And Tannen had done some of her earliest work on friend interaction, which, you know, led her to this observation. And these are exactly the kind of things that I ended up focusing on in my work. You know, these playful routines, allusion, familiar jokes, and all this kind of stuff. So throughout the course of about a year, I recorded 40 conversations, primarily among American millennials. And since I know we have some people that are not from the U.S. in the audience, I just wanted to focus on that for a sec and talk about how these are in the U.S. context, kind of loosely defined as people born between around 1981 to 1996. It's not really like a robust theoretical concept, but it's more just a construct that we seem to like in the U.S. To group people into generations. And this is kind of one that has taken hold. So I transcribed a set of five of these conversations in more detail. I chose these specifically because they have what I was looking for once I got interested in media references. So there were 10 participants across these five conversations. In my book, I go into more detail about like the demographic info on these people, you know, who they were, where they were from, and all that kind of stuff. But for the sake of time, I'll move on. I also conducted playback interviews with these speakers. So this is something done by a couple prior researchers. This is where you take the conversation you recorded and you sit down with the people you recorded it with and you just play it back to them and you open it up for their interpretations and to get some of their insights. And that was particularly useful to me because after a while, I got really good at hearing when something was referenced, but that didn't mean I always understood what the reference was. So by playing this back to my participants, they could often fill in those gaps for me. So in the end, I identified 148 media references. And in my other work, this isn't the focus of today, but I'll just briefly say that I've looked at how these are phonetically signaled in the speech stream through a variety of phonetic cues in spoken American English, but primarily through stress and intonation. So people will often stress, they'll do some vowel elongation and some loudness to kind of highlight the media reference for listeners so that it stands out from the surrounding talk. And I have also looked at how people respond to or react and show that they've heard or maybe understood these references. And just the most common way is through laughter, as you'll see in the talk, but there's other ways that I, you know, look at in my other work as well. Okay, and then so a preview of the findings and what I'll be showing you throughout the talk. So I'm taking kind of the work that Cynthia Gordon has already done for us, showing how intertextuality and framing are linked. And I'm kind of merging this with the study of epistemics to bring a more explicit focus to knowledge in this process of identity construction. So these American millennial friends in my study use media references in their everyday conversations to resolve interactional dilemmas and epistemic imbalances. So epistemic imbalances refers to when at least one member of the conversation doesn't share the same kind of access to knowledge as the other participants. And that often coincides or results in some kind of awkwardness. So you have the interactional dilemma. And these speakers re-key this kind of serious or awkward talk about real life issues to humorous play frames. And they also enact epistemic shifts at the same time. So they do this to construct solidarity and shared group identity, to share memories and to construct group norms as well. So again, this is why I call this epistemic frame shifts, because you see both the knowledge and the frame shifting at once when you get these media references. Okay, and so I'm going to show you a video game reference example now. So now we get to look at more data. All right, so in this example, Dave, who is my partner, and his childhood best friend, Alan, and me are all sitting around talking at a diner. And Dave and me are telling a story about a kayaking trip we just went on that did not go very well, as you'll see in the conversation. And there's more detail about that whole story in my book, because it actually sparked a lot of conversation afterwards when I was recording. And it prompted a lot of these media references just because of all the unpleasant and awkward things that happened on this camping trip. So anyway, here, Alan, who was not on the trip, he makes a video game reference to participate. And this, as you will see, shifts the tone, the frame, and the knowledge territory of the talk. So doing one of those epistemic frame shifts, which in turn constructs the shared group identity around the media text. So let's take a look.
Get on it.
And I hit my head, felt kind of dizzy. Decided to go in the canoe.
That sounds like a bad Oregon Trail trip.
And now
Sylvia, not Sylvia.
As a concussion.
She will be unable to collect food.
Okay, so this is one of the earliest examples that I was very excited actually to get when this happened, because it was my second video game example once I was attuned to them. So, you know, it happens here when Alan says, sounds like a bad Oregon Trail trip. And later he says, Sylvia knocked her head. Dave says, Sylvia has a concussion. So they're kind of playfully making fun of me here. And later we have this line, she will be unable to collect food for the rest of the trip, so you can only carry 100 pounds less. So again, some of you might have gotten the reference, but for those of you who didn't, the video game in question is the Oregon Trail, which again was a popular video game for children in North America in the early 90s. It was played at school. So this is an image of a screen from the Oregon Trail. So this says you are now at the Kansas River crossing. Would you like to look around? And then it has a bunch of little factoids down here. So in this game, you're basically an early American pioneer, and you're trying to make it across the West to Oregon. And it involves river crossing. So this is presumably what causes Alan to think of this game. We're talking about kayaking and canoeing, having to go across a river to get to our campsite. Also in this game, bad things happen. So Ashley has a broken arm. This is a screen you would get. And this, of course, refers to the way that Alan and Dave are saying, Sylvia has a concussion. So you can see it here, actually. Sylvia knocked her head. Sylvia has a concussion. So I really like the way, you know, they phonetically signaled this through the stress pattern and the unique intonation contour, because this is just something you see on a screen. But they made this, you know, something that was recognizable in the conversation as coming from this video game text. And then this is another relevant screen. So this says from in the game, you can shoot animals to get food. So it says from the animals you shot, you got 2,949 pounds of meat. However, you were only able to carry 100 pounds back to the wagon. So this relates to Alan when he says she will be unable to collect food for the rest of the trip. So you can only carry 100 pounds less. So let's look at the example again now. And as you can see here in line one, I'm talking about how I had hit my head in the kayak as like practice. I had hit my head. I felt kind of dizzy. So this is kind of unpleasant. And, you know, Alan was not there, so he's listening. But I have this little laughter token here, which kind of signals to him that this, you know, is something that could be laughed about. And in line three, he does that. I continue telling this story that I decided to go in the canoe instead of continue in a kayak. And then this is where you get that media reference. Sounds like a bad Oregon Trail trip. And both I and Dave, well, I try to, you know, continue telling the story initially, but I stop. Dave orients to Alan and says something like that. And then Alan continues with this. Sylvia knocked her head. Dave, you know, continues. Sylvia has a concussion. I'm just laughing there. And then Alan continues to quote the video game and everyone is laughing at the end. So here we had kind of an awkward, unpleasant real life experience and one that Alan was not, you know, a participant in. But this media reference kind of comes into this awkward space and this gap, and it allows Alan a way to really participate in this conversation. So it shifts the epistemic territory required to participate in the talk so that Alan can participate and everyone here can participate, because it's assumed that we all know this game. And then you get that frame shift too, to one that is, you know, lighthearted and everyone is laughing. And ultimately it contributes to this group identity construction as, you know, millennials and friends who have all, you know, experienced playing this game in school many years ago. And now I'll talk a little more about this image that graces the cover of my book. So this, I got interested in these video game references, I realized, oh, wow, you know, actually in my partner Dave's house, where he lived with all these housemates and their cats, you know, they had this mural right when you walk in the front room that Lana, that's her pseudonym, but she, with the paintbrush and paint can, had painted this of all the housemates as video game characters and even the cats. So this kind of made me realize, like, wow, they really, you know, do relate to video games. And that kind of, you know, became my early area of interest in this, but I eventually expanded it outward to look at other kinds of media references as well. So I'm going to show you another video game reference. And this one, I actually feel like I need to give you more background up front, because there's a lot going on here. And this is also less, you know, popular than the Oregon Trail. So this is a newer game from 2013. It's called like a dystopian puzzle game. And in this game, you're actually playing an immigration officer in a fictional dystopian country called Arstotzka. And it's kind of modeled after, like East Germany. And it's kind of intentionally stressful. It's not supposed to be like a pleasant or fun game. And in this game, some things that will come up in the talk I'm going to show you, you're assigned this, job as the immigration officer through a job lottery. and you're also paid in credits. So I'm telling you these details because they're going to appear in the talk. And there's also this specific character, reoccurring character, Georgie, who is known for trying to show up with forged passports and things like that. So he will come up as well. So in this recording, what's relevant here is that Dave, my partner, and his housemates, Todd, Fred, and Lana, and two other friends, we had all played this game together a few weeks before I began my recording. So we had played this together in a basement, and it, you know, started coming up a lot. It was a bonding experience. So this is a screenshot from the game. So this is like your desk as the immigration officer. You can see like the physical kind of border patrol area out here. And you have these stamps to deny or approve passports. And this is Georgie, the character I mentioned. And here is his falsified passport. So just to give you an idea of what this game looks like and what these speakers are envisioning, perhaps. This is a sample of Georgie talking, and I wanted to show this because they kind of present his speech in this kind of disfluent, non-standard syntax. So this says, now I have passport, Arstotzka's still best country for sure. So this is how Georgie is portrayed as talking in the game, kind of like he's a foreigner or not fluent in whatever the language of the game is, I guess, even though it's presented in English for English speakers. Okay, so now let's look at this example. So I'm just going to set up the context. So Lana, Dave, and Fred, who were housemates, and I were together at their house. And what's relevant here is that Lana and Dave and I, again, were in the same graduate program at the time, but Fred was not. So he was not a graduate student. And this is going to be relevant because, again, this is part of that same conversation I showed you in the first example where we're actually discussing the term intertextuality and we actually start like making a lot of jokes and puns and things about that. So as you'll see in this example, I had been discussing how my professor in the seminar I was taking on intertextuality, Heidi Hamilton, she had proposed this activity called Intertextuality in the Wild, where we would like bring in examples, you know, from outside the class of intertextuality. And I make this really silly and kind of tasteless joke here saying intertextuality gone wild, referring to these Girls Gone Wild commercials that, again, were like all over like late night TV in the early 90s in the US. So you'll see that. And then this gone wild bit kind of, as you'll see, triggers Lana to start talking about getting paid and getting her stipend check, which we had received late. From our department. So you'll also see, this is just a lot of context to help you understand it. You'll see this Borat voice use. So this is coming from a film, a mockumentary about a fictional Kazakh journalist who speaks in a particular performative accent. So you'll see that. And that's what eventually triggers the video game reference, you know, to this video game that I just showed you. And that's going to result in the epistemic frame shift in the identity construction. So it's a lot of background, but let's look at the example.
Oh man. Intertextuality gone wild.
References.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah,
no,
right?
Finally.
God, I can pay my fucking rent.
That first art always seems so delayed.
Yeah.
We have been paid by our Arstotzka.
You received some credits for processing the language. I feel like you drew this job.
They all came from
laundry.
Georgie. Georgie's like, hey! I make a passport.
All right, so there's a lot going on here. I'll try to break this down a little bit. So again, in line one, I make this silly reference, intertextuality gone wild, which again, this is actually a media reference itself to those Girls Gone Wild commercials. And actually, this first triggers Dave to say, woo, references, woo. And that's also referencing those commercials because they would feature young women shouting woo a lot and actually pulling up their tops and exposing themselves for the camera. So anyway, he makes that joke there. And Lana is laughing here. And she says, speaking of gone wild, we got paid. So this makes her think of the fact that we had just gotten paid from our graduate program. So Dave and I aligned to her. You know, here I say, oh, yeah, finally. Dave says, yeah, I know, right? And then Lana says, God, I can pay my fucking rent. So this is pretty marked here on the, you know, conversation have been pretty playful up to this point. So there's actually a little frame shift here where things get more serious and Lana is like cursing and she's talking about her rent. And again, I align with her to that, saying that first check always seems so delayed. And she starts trying to explain this to Fred that our stipends came late. Because remember, Fred is not a graduate student, so he doesn't really know what this talk is about necessarily. So for whatever reason, he just starts saying, yes, yes, in this Borat voice. It's sort of, I don't know, like I said, a performative, I don't know, Kazakh accent, I guess, or like a Russian accent, maybe. So that continues for a couple lines, and Lana does it as well. And actually, at the time, I had never seen Borat, so I didn't really know what this was. But just hearing that accent made me think of the video game. So I say, we have been paid by our Stotska, and I perform some kind of accent here. I don't know if it's Russian, but it's, you know, some kind of performative accent. And then, you know, Fred laughs at this, Lana laughs. There's kind of this brief pause here where everyone kind of reorients and gets this joke. And again, you know, this allows Fred to participate more. So he says, you receive some credits for processing the language. So here he's referring to how we got paid for basically being a linguist or, you know, studying linguistics in our graduate program. So there's all this laughter here. You can see how the frame has, you know, been changed to a more playful one. And of course, the epistemic territory has shifted along that because now we're talking about this video game. So Fred continues in line 16, you're lucky you drew this job in the labor lottery. So again, referring to the labor lottery in the game. And then Lana gets even more specific here, referencing that character, Georgie, and says they all came from Georgie. Georgie's like, hey, and she kind of does this like voice for Georgie. And then that continues down here in line 21. She says something like, I make a passport. So again, I don't know if it's like really an Italian accent per se. This is actually an older transcript, but it's some kind of performative, maybe like foreign sounding accent. To me, it kind of sounds like a Mario from the Mario video game. But anyway, as you can see here, there was, you know, something a little unpleasant and awkward being talked about the rent, and Fred did not have the epistemic access to participate in that talk. So this video game reference again comes in and it shifts the whole frame and the epistemic territory to be something that all these speakers actually do know about and that they can laugh and bond over. And I'll just mention too that this was actually recorded before I ever knew what the heck I was going to do with all this conversational data. So this was one of the first examples I ended up analyzing because I remembered that we had talked about video games in it. But, you know, this was before I even knew we were going to be doing this. So I just mentioned that because some of these examples do have me prompting the reference, but they were from before I knew that I was going to be examining this exact thing. Okay. And let's see, I'm trying to see my titles here. Okay, so now we'll look at some meme references. So I have a whole chapter in the book on memes and meme references. So I'm going to show you a set of memes. So this one says, friends don't let friends skip leg day. And it shows a picture of a man at a gym and he has a very bulky upper body, but he has quite underdeveloped thin legs. So this was a popular meme back on the internet a few years ago now. And then there's some related ones. So this is actually just a photo of a random gym owner, I guess, but it says, do you even lift? And then people would also add bro to this and other memes. So bro, do you even lift? So I'm showing you these because these are going to be referenced in the conversation. Okay. So in this example, we're going to look at Todd and his friend, John. They are painting miniature model rats for a board game called Myth. And they are watching and commenting on a YouTube video at the same time. So this is a picture of Todd's rats that he proudly painted for his board game. Just to give you some more context. And so this is actually happening at this table. And Lana, Dave, and I are just kind of sitting there hanging out. We're not participating in the rat painting, but we are there. And this is going on when Fred and his new girlfriend, Dee, walk in and they encounter this strange activity happening at the table. So with this awkwardness, this is the perfect place for a media reference. And you'll see references to the leg day meme. And again, they cause the epistemic frame shift and the resulting construction of a shared group identity. So let's look at this example.
Seeing all the miniatures.
We're painting rats today. We're painting rats
today. I forgot today was Christmas.
You should have known.
I'm sorry.
You never skip rat day. What are you doing?
Never skip. Friends don't let friends skip rat day.
Exactly. Somebody was over here being like, Scott, I don't even paint.
Bro, do you even paint?
Okay. All right. So once again, you know, this is just Todd. Actually, he's commenting on the YouTube video here. And this is when Fred and Dee have just walked in and Fred asks, painting all the miniatures. And actually, again, this is a media reference. This is referring to this webcomic at the time that had gotten popular, where the person in the webcomic had said, like, do all the chores. And this kind of like verb all the X construction was very popular at that time, at least in the US. So here he says painting all the miniatures, kind of ironically. And you know, I say, yeah, Todd says we're painting rats today. And I, you know, kind of echo that or say it at the same time, rats. And you know, Fred orients to this saying, ah. And Todd says, we're painting rats today. And Fred says here, today is rat day. So here he was kind of just making fun of this as if this was like, you know, laundry day or something. So this gets laughter. Fred says, I forgot today was rat day. And this is where the meme reference comes in. So Lana says, it's like leg day. And then there's some teasing here from Dave. You should have known, Fred. Fred says, I'm sorry, I forgot rat day. And John makes another meme reference here. Rat day, what are you doing? And Fred, as he often does, sort of does a repair on this and almost like ones up John and says, friends don't let friends skip rat day. And Lana also completes that format there, which is interesting. And this gets laughter. Eventually, Todd actually tries to kind of shift back to the kind of real life frame, saying Sylvia was over here being like, Todd, why won't you let me paint some rats? He was just making fun of me there. I had, you know, very little interest and was actually kind of grossed out by the rats. But then in the end, Fred has one more reference here and he says, bro, do you even paint? So in this example, you can really see once again how there was this awkwardness and how Fred and his new girlfriend, you know, did not know what was going on here. And all these meme references come in to shift the frame to a really playful, silly one that everyone can relate to because everyone knew these memes. And it's also a cool example because here you can really see how they're taking these prior texts, but they're adapting them. So instead of, you know, being leg day, it's rat day, right? And friends don't let friends skip rat day instead of leg day. And then at the end, instead of bro, do you even lift? We get bro, do you even paint? So that just speaks to, you know, these intertextual processes and how they are taking these prior texts and they're modifying them and they're using them to map onto their real life interactional dilemmas here. And ultimately this functions to construct this shared identity as people who had all seen these memes. And also it kind of functions to, you know, make fun of and kind of tease about this nerdy activity that's going on here. And I talk more about that in my book. And if you're interested, I also talk a lot about like masculinity and how that relates to this as well. And then in one of my playback interviews, Fred actually said this about this excerpt. He said, I guess what I was going for was a way to make it a humorous situation in which everyone could participate and be put at ease. So this was really interesting, exciting to me, because this is exactly what I was observing through a theoretical viewpoint as what was happening in these conversations. And this is Fred actually showing some meta-linguistic or meta-communicative awareness that he may be, you know, it's who knows, you know, but he's claiming that he was actually intentionally trying to do this interactional work of shifting the frame and making it something everyone could participate in and be put at ease. So I just thought that was really interesting. And Fred is the most prolific media referencer in, you know, my data set. Okay, so I'm going to kind of start to wrap up here. So again, to summarize, I looked at how intertextuality and framing function together and brought in epistemics to further illuminate those knowledge processes implicated in the process of identity construction. I showed how friends use media references in their everyday conversations to resolve interactional dilemmas and epistemic imbalances. And also how they rekey serious talk about real life issues to humorous play frames while also enacting epistemic shifts. And these epistemic shifts contribute to constructing a shared group identity as American millennials and as many other things. So I just kind of focused on that in this talk. But again, in the book, I talk about different things like gender identities, sexuality, and also things like being like native English speakers and all these other different things. And then for future work, you might have noticed all my work here today was just audio recorded, but it would really be great to look at some video data to get, you know, different aspects of the interaction, like facial expressions and gesture and things like that. A lot of my work actually since publishing my book, well, throughout the book and, you know, since then has been on media ideologies and stereotypes and media references. So you might have seen that through some of these references. There are some interesting linguistic and maybe racial and gender ideologies in a lot of the media we consume, and that, you know, gets replicated when we reference them. So I talk about that in the book as well, and I'm further interested in exploring that. I'm also interested in references to other forms of new media, especially in Gen Z conversations. So that's kind of what I'm looking at now is conversations among my own students who are all members of Gen Z at this point and looking at how they reference media and what kinds of media they reference. And so that ties into looking at media references across different social groups as well, because, you know, my dissertation data was just me and my friends, but we're just one, you know, a little subset, a little slice of American culture. So it's definitely interesting to pursue this in other groups and in other languages, in different contexts. And actually, I think I'm going to save. Let me see if I can skip ahead real quick. Ah, okay. All right, sorry. I just wanted to end here because I think we're running out of time and I want to take questions. So thank you. And I will look at the chat, which I haven't been looking at, and we can take some questions.